Today in the studio, we have Katie Fox. Katie is currently serving as FEMA's Acting Deputy Administrator, Protection and National Preparedness. Prior to her current role, she was the Assistant Administrator for the National Preparedness Directorate. And before that, Katie was the Director of FEMA's National Preparedness Assessment Division. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's begin with your background. Virtually all of the successful women that we've had on this show have had a big influence or inspiration in their lives growing up. So who or what was your biggest influence?
I don't know that I have just one inspiration growing up. There are so many people who have influenced me over the years. I think when I think back to being a kid, one thing that I found really inspirational was a columnist for first the Chicago Sun-Times and then the Chicago Tribune. His name was Mike Royko. And, you know, as far as columnists go, he's legendary. And he always took the tact of fighting for the little guy. And so his columns would be about, you know, somebody who was down on their luck or had a run-in with, you know, the bureaucracy or whatever it was, or just crazy things that politicians would do in Chicago. And I just was always inspired by the way that he looked at things and always was looking out for the little guy. And that's something that has stuck with me.
So did you think at some point of your life that maybe you would want to grow up and be a journalist?
No, no, I didn't. But I did find his stories inspirational.
So you grew up in Chicago or around Chicago?
I did. I grew up on the southwest side of the city.
Okay. And big family, little family?
My immediate family is not very big. I have two sisters, but my mom has an enormous extended family. And so a great place to grow up.
So tell us, what was your first job?
My very first job was working in a dime store, you know, one of those stores that there aren't very many of anymore that sell everything from toys to thread to candy to whatever. And my mom's cousin owned it, so I worked there while I was in high school. And went on to work for a family-owned jewelry store where I worked all through high school and college and just learned a ton about a family business and how to treat the customers of the business and kind of how to be successful and how to work hard.
But you decided you didn't want a career in retail either.
Indeed. Indeed.
So then you went to the University of Wisconsin.
I did.
And you majored in political science.
Mm-hmm.
What caused you to do that?
Well, I chose the University of Wisconsin because it's got a beautiful campus, and I went up there with my dad on a lovely fall day, and you could sit around the campus, I noticed, and drink beer, and people were selling, you know, crystals and all sorts of things on State Street, and I thought that seemed like a pretty nice place to be. So those were my main criteria for choosing the University of Wisconsin, and it worked out great for me.
It's so funny now, you know, I think my children are older, but I remember going through the college selection process, and you always think about, you know, class size and the teachers and, you know, all of the things. And it's just the kids never do, right? They want a nice campus. They want cool stuff to do.
So. It looked like a fun place to be.
Exactly.
And indeed it was.
And so how about political science? What was your thought there?
Yeah, I went into college undecided. I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to major in. And I took a political science class because I, you know, sounded interesting. And I just absolutely loved it. It just, it clicked right away for me. And I ended up double majoring in history because I just really enjoyed those classes the most and studied abroad. I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to do that my junior year and spent about 6 months in London. And it was just a phenomenal experience.
And so then coming out of the University of Wisconsin, what was your first real job after graduating?
My first real job after waiting tables was working for the Chicago Police Department. And I got a job as an analyst in the research and development division. At the time, community policing was kind of all the rage. This was the mid-90s. And so that's what folks were spending a lot of energy on. And I just had such an incredible experience. It was educational, of course, and really inspirational to work with all of those law enforcement officers.
So then what brought you to D.C.?
What brought me to D.C. was graduate school. So after a couple of years of working for the CPD, I realized that I'd like to, you know, do some other things in the world and live someplace different. And so I applied to some grad schools and ended up here in Washington with the intent of just staying for a couple of years and then moving back to Chicago or someplace else and ended up staying here.
And so your first time out of graduate school, you were with a consulting firm. Mm-hmm. You spent about 10 years there. And that was a firm that worked with the government, specifically with DHS, in the area of preparedness, right?
Yes.
So what did you just kind of fall into that area? Did you seek that out? How did you decide to get, because you've been in preparedness ever since. So how did you decide to get into that area of specialty?
Yeah, I can't say that it was so much a decision as something that I fell into. So when I first moved out here, I worked on Capitol Hill answering phones and realized that that was really not the place or the job for me. So I lasted a couple of months doing that. And then there was a consulting firm that offered, you know, $2 an hour more or something like that, which at the time was really appealing. And so I started there and worked just a series of different projects. This was before the Department of Homeland Security had been created. So I worked a number of different projects with the Department of Defense. And some of them were really interesting in the strategy realm, looking at global demographics and kind of trying to look out into the future to see what trends and effects would have some sort of impact on national security. And then after 9/11, of course, a lot of things changed in the world. And one of the areas that we pursued as a business was Homeland Security. And so having spent some time at the local level working for a police department, and then having spent some time working at the national level, mostly with the Department of Defense and with a degree in foreign policy, it just kind of meshed. And we started working for the Memorial Institute for the Prevention of Terrorism, trying to put together some lessons learned for different first responders. And so it was fortuitous that I had a good mix of different skills and experience in my background.
So, you know, when I think about preparedness and I think about FEMA, where you are now, or just in general, that concept, and it's such a broad concept, right? Because it's everything from national security to, the wildfires that are going on now on the West Coast, other natural disasters like earthquakes and hurricanes and tornadoes, along with, you know, always the kind of looming potential of nuclear war or something. And so I guess how do you think about kind of this concept of preparedness?
Yeah, the concept of preparedness is incredibly broad. And I think that's one of the things that I really like about it is you can approach it a number of different ways. And it has its roots, I think, if we're doing it well, in behavioral science. And so trying to understand, A, what resonates with people. So what kinds of messages and things will get people to take some preparedness actions. And then understanding what people are likely to do in an emergency. And people react differently. You know, folks who've had a lot of different training, whether they're first responders or in the military, tend to respond in ways that they have been trained. And that's different than folks who haven't had that training. And so our messaging and the work that we do has to cover that broad gamut of people. But people tend to react predictably in terms of evacuations and other things. And so it really, what I like about preparedness is the ability to do something that is helpful to people, to have them make a family plan or do any of the things that they can to better prepare themselves for an incident. Some of the folks, for example, in California who faced the wildfires and really just had a couple of minutes to evacuate, folks who had some of those things together and understood what would be most important to them and what would help them recover most quickly, found that was comforting and also useful to them in getting back on their feet. So being able to lay some of those things out and have done work to lay the groundwork for people is something that I really enjoy.
So I have to ask you, when I read about your background, the one question I thought was, were you a Girl Scout growing up? Because
no,
I actually think it's the Boy Scouts that it's part of their motto to always be prepared. But
it,
you know,
it is. Yeah, I was a brownie for a couple of years.
I just liked the campouts. I pictured this young Katie, like with all your Girl Scout badges, being super prepared.
No.
Well, so you have now, like I mentioned, a decade of private sector experience. You spent a couple of years working for the DC government, and then you've been at FEMA for almost a decade. So what do you see the kind of big differences between private sector, maybe some local government from your DC or your Chicago time, and then the federal government?
Yeah, I think they're pretty different. I mean, the time in the private sector was probably during the most formative years of my career. You know, right after graduate school, and I spent 10 years with a small firm. It was very small when I started and then grew to be a couple hundred folks when I was leaving. And you know, the things that I really liked about the private sector were the ability to be entrepreneurial. And, you know, we could go after different kinds of projects and things were changing all of the time. I mean, that's one of the great things about consulting. And you get to choose your team. You know, we're always recruiting great talent, and you have the compelling work of that the government does because you're supporting them. And at the same time, you get to control the environment because you're in the private sector. And I really appreciated that. And then what I wanted to do after having completed, you know, that leg of my career working in the private sector was work at the local or state level. We were helping the federal government write doctrine and policy and all these sorts of things, but I wanted to have a sense of how that affected people and whether we were doing a good job of it. And so having the opportunity to work here in the district, it was just really phenomenal. And it was incredibly different than being in a consulting firm, as you can imagine. Just the environment is different. The type of work that you're doing, the personnel challenges, the management challenges, other things are really different in the government. And so I was there a couple of years. And then the federal government, you know, again, is different. It's a much bigger place than working at the local level. You know, you're not until this past hurricane season, I wasn't typically getting woken up at 3 a.m. for things. And there's much more of that at an emergency management agency in the local level. And at the federal level, one of the things that I really appreciated about FEMA is that it satisfies that part of me that's always seeking an entrepreneurial environment. So as far as federal agencies go, FEMA is a pretty small one. We certainly have the ability to expand. But we're, you know, a couple of thousand folks as opposed to being in the Department of Homeland Security. If you're working at headquarters, you've got a couple hundred thousand. And so we're able to innovate and do things a little bit differently. And disasters and emergencies really force that kind of innovation. And so it's an environment that I've really appreciated.
Today in the studio, we're talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator, FEMA. Coming up, we'll ask Katie about her role at FEMA. You're listening to Women of Washington with Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we're talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator for FEMA. So Katie, prepare, prevent, protect. Those are the three P's of FEMA. Can you describe how you've been able to apply those concepts, you know, in your job day to day, but also maybe how people can apply them in their daily lives?
Yeah, that's a great question. So prevent, protect, prepare. I mean, there are all steps that you can take to put yourself in a better position should you find yourself in an emergency situation. And that emergency situation can be that you're evacuating from a wildfire, you're evacuating in advance of a flood or a hurricane, or, you know, that somebody is hurt in front of you and you need to call 911 or try to see what you can do to help them. And I think, you know, really of all of the things that we do, that kind of personal connection, that personal preparedness is one of the most meaningful things. We've got a program called You Are the Help Until Help Arrives. And of all of the things that I've done at FEMA, I think that is the one that my team has done that I'm most proud of. And it's, you know, a couple minute video that you can get on the FEMA website. And it gives people some really basic steps that they can take should they find themselves next to somebody who's been injured. And there is a substantial number of people, especially below the age of 40, who suffer from trauma. And so whether it's that, you know, somebody's in a bike accident right in front of you, that actually happened this summer, We were on vacation at the beach, and there was a bicyclist who was injured by a car that happened right in front of us. And so I was very much thinking about that. You are the help until help arrives. So we, of course, called 911 immediately, but then, you know, looked to make sure that the person was able to breathe and they weren't bleeding, all those sorts of things. And so really just making sure that you put yourself in a position to be helpful to somebody should you be in that need.
You know, one of the organizations that I've had a lot of personal experience with is the Red Cross. And they do, you know, nonprofit, obviously, but they kind of cross over in a lot of the areas where FEMA gets involved. How much does FEMA get involved with nonprofit organizations like Red Cross to, help, I guess, increase the number of efforts that are brought when people are suffering from some disaster?
We have a tremendous partnership with the Red Cross and really with the nonprofit community. There's a group called the National Volunteer Agencies, Volunteer Organizations Active in Disasters, and VOAD. And so there's a huge group of them. So the Red Cross, you know, the Salvation Army, and a number of others that provide services for folks in disasters. So the Red Cross does everything from help families who have experienced a house fire and put them up in a hotel for the night. That happens all over the place in local jurisdictions. And also have massive feeding missions and other things. And so as we were going through this crazy hurricane season, we sat around the table a couple of times a day and went around with something we call emergency support functions. So there's one for transportation and law enforcement, kind of the different things that are essential for coordinating in an emergency. And mass care is one of them. And the Red Cross actually leads that for us. So it is, and they are the only nonprofit that are at the table. So those partnerships are essential to the work of disaster relief and response and preparedness as well. They go around and help folks by putting smoke alarms in people's houses. And so we have a strong partnership, everything from, you know, prevention to preparedness to response and recovery.
So what do you and the rest of FEMA's executive leadership team do to help establish a good reputation for FEMA?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say that at FEMA, we worry far less about our reputation, and what we, you know, are concerned about is supporting survivors of disasters. And that is where we spend all of our time and energy, from the executive level down to our most junior employees. And, it, you know, if we're providing the support that people need on their worst day, then, you know, I think that that's what makes this job worthwhile.
And I guess if they never have to be aware of FEMA because they don't have a worse day, that's a good thing, too.
Exactly. I mean, we in the preparedness space like to think that if folks are aware of the preparedness steps that they can take, and whether they know that it's FEMA who's behind them or not, that makes absolutely no difference to me. It's just a matter of getting that message out and folks trying to take a couple of steps to be prepared for any type of incident that they may face.
Today in the studio, we're talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator, FEMA. So, Katie, one of your main objectives in your current job is to work toward building community resilience in times of distress. What would you say has been the most difficult part of that current job?
I think the most difficult part of my current job is that only about half of the folks in this country have taken any steps to be prepared in the event of an emergency. And while we've seen that number increase over the last couple of years, it really hovers around 50%. And there are people who are facing all sorts of dire circumstances in their everyday life. Our administrator has talked a lot about a concept called liquid asset poverty, which is that more than half of Americans don't have a couple hundred bucks to spare in the event of an emergency. And that can be a healthcare crisis. It can be, you know, a car repair that is expensive, and folks are really struggling. And so to try to get through with a preparedness message about, you know, make sure that you have all your important documents together, make sure that you have extra personal medicine, make sure that you have insurance, you know, whether it's health insurance or flood insurance, renter's insurance, homeowner's insurance. Those things help you get back on your feet far more quickly if you do find yourself in an emergency situation. So I think, you know, trying to figure out how to have that message land on and folks in a way that they're able to take action is the biggest challenge, certainly in the preparedness space that we face.
Have you had any instances in your past life or maybe just past work life that has really resonated with you and let you, you know, prepared you for being able to help build this resilience in other people? I mean, have you seen kind of inspiring stories of people bouncing back, or do you have any from your own background?
I have been very fortunate that way and not faced natural disaster or otherwise. So I don't, you know, that wasn't what led me into preparedness, I think. But one of the things that I will say is when I was working in the DC's Homeland Security and Emergency Management Agency, one of the most meaningful things that we did in the time that I was there was prepare for the 2009 inauguration. And we had more than 2 million people here in the district, and the threat environment was high. I mean, there were all sorts of reasons that folks were concerned about it. And so figuring out how to creatively prepare for that and how to make sure that the celebration, you know, was peaceful and safe for everybody on what turned out to be a really cold January 20th was something that, you know, just every little thing to consider about how folks would get in and how folks would get out and how they would cross over streets and how we would make sure that there was enough medical personnel and there were enough medical supplies and having ambulances and law enforcement and everything else at the ready in case something did go wrong was a project, if you will, that really stretched me in all kinds of ways to think creatively about how we could approach that. And I would suspect that the others who worked on plans for that inauguration would say the same thing.
So you have created a 35-member task force at FEMA to help you. Tell us a little bit about the task force. What's the purpose of it? You know, how is it doing, achieving its goals?
Sure. This that was the Preparedness Task Force, and that goes back several years. And what the Congress asked us to do was pull together a task force to get some recommendations on how we could approach preparedness in a more productive way. So this goes back 7 or 8 years ago now. And so what we did was pull together the smartest, most accomplished, most experienced folks that we could think of and who were willing to help us. And fortunately, all of them were. And we really talked about everything from preparedness messaging to our Homeland Security grant funds and how we could use those as effectively as possible and really what we might want to think about in the preparedness space. And we structured some of our programs differently as a result of the task force recommendations. And they really kind of set us, you know, in the last 7 or 8 years on a path for what we've done in preparedness, what we've pursued in terms of individual and community preparedness, but also of our Homeland Security grant funds and basing them on risk and trying to measure some of that risk and measure levels of capability. So, you know, when you ever have a really wicked problem pulling together 35 or so friends and colleagues who have great ideas is certainly a great way to make that happen.
Today in the studio, we're talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator for FEMA. Coming up, we'll ask Katie about mentors in her career. You're listening to Women of Washington with Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we're talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator for FEMA. So, Katie, we talk about mentorship quite a bit on this show. And so tell me, have you had important mentors in your career?
I have absolutely had important mentors. I've never really had one, though, where I had a formal mentoring relationship. So I don't know that I've ever asked anyone to be my mentor. I just have you know, have just been fortunate enough to work with or for people who have played that role for me.
So can you think about what's the best advice that you've ever received from a mentor, or maybe the worst advice that you've ever received from a mentor?
One of the best pieces of advice wasn't given directly to me, and this came from the last Secretary of Homeland Security, Secretary Johnson. And what he said to a group of us at FEMA was that some advice that he had offered was, do whatever job you have as well as you possibly can. And so that goes from, you know, working in a corner dime store to a family-run jewelry store to being at FEMA. So think less about what your next step is and just work incredibly hard at what you're doing. And certainly for me, the next steps have always followed sort of naturally when I have been able to follow that advice.
You know, we sometimes talk about the difference between mentorship and sponsorship. And your answer to that question brought to mind that I think that typically most women do follow kind of a path like that, where they do a very good job and hope that it gets noticed. It sounds like you've been pretty lucky along those lines, and that it has, and you've been able to progress your career. Have there been times, though, when you felt like that wasn't working, that you had to advocate for yourself, or maybe that you had to seek out the help of a sponsor, somebody who was going to advocate for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, doing a good job and then being able to progress through your career is sort of basic advice. But I think everybody runs into challenges along the way, and those can be different kinds. I mean, one of the things about emergency management or homeland security, national security, really even more broadly, is that it tends to be a male-dominated field. And so, you know, I sit around a conference table at any number of different meetings, and typically there will be two or three women and, you know, 15 or 20 men. And so that means a couple of different things. It's just that the environment tends to be pretty different, and it's when you don't have a lot of diversity in terms of the makeup of the folks around the table, the environment is just different. And so one of the biggest challenges, I think, is figuring out how to be heard in those situations. And so there have been a lot of articles written recently about, you know, how it can be difficult for women to have their voice heard. So either, you know, screwing up the courage to actually say what you want to say and feeling confident about that, or, you know, finding a way to get a word in edgewise when everybody else is dominating the conversation. And so for me, I think those have been some of the really big challenges, is just having the confidence to speak up and, you know, ask a tough question, or one that I think might be dumb, or any situation like that, and doing that in an environment where it can be pretty intimidating.
Yeah, I think, you know, you read a lot about mansplaining, but I think we've all been in circumstances where, I know I have, where I've said something and it's gone unheard or unnoticed. And then, you know, 5-10 minutes later, some guy in the room says the exact same thing. And it's like, oh, so-and-so, that's a great idea,
exactly.
You know?
Yes.
And so it is sometimes a challenge to be heard in those male-dominated circumstances, for sure.
It is. And I think one of the things, as I have talked to other, you know, women and men, and played a mentor role for others, and they have asked what criteria I've used to choose jobs and to, you know, make changes in my career. And the thing that, as I think about it, has been really consistent for me is to find somebody that I really want to work for. So that is really important to me. And, you know, statistics tell us that your boss is the biggest factor in your day. You know, people leave jobs not because of money typically or other things, it's because of who they work for. And so that has been kind of my guiding principle, is just work for somebody that I find inspirational and whom I like and want to work hard for. And I have been incredibly fortunate in that regard. And while I've had a few female bosses along the way, there have been far more men, and all of them have been really good at making sure that I was able to get my voice heard and being, you know, welcoming of my opinion. And so that, to me, that advice about, you know, find somebody that you want to work for and that is going to encourage you is hugely important.
Today in the studio, we're talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator, FEMA. So speaking of being a boss that people want to work for, let's talk about your leadership style, right? Because you've gone from being an individual contributor, and then through your career, now you lead a very, very large team at FEMA. And so Tell me a little bit about your leadership style and how you try to be a boss that is inspirational, that people want to work for.
Sure. Man, I don't know that I try to be inspirational. I try just not to be a jerk, you know, just be somebody that is compassionate and really that gives people the space that they need and empowers them. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest things is to give folks enough encouragement, give them the resources and provide them the support that they need to be successful, but also to step back and let them do that. And so I'm perfectly happy to delegate things. You know, if somebody else wants to do the hard work, then that's fine by me. And then they'll get all the glory for it. And so really, I think that's it, is just there are a few things that are really important to me in the work that we do. And that's, you know, making sure that we're making data driven decisions. And so that's an area where I tend to push the folks that work on my team, is making sure that we're making recommendations based on good, you know, solid evidence about things. But and then really just being compassionate and empowering them. One of the things that I'll say that one of the bosses that I've had at FEMA was that I had just come back from maternity leave after having my first son. And I didn't expect that it would be so hard to come back to work. I have always liked the work that I do. And my first couple of days back in the office, man, they were rough. And he called me up to his office, and he was the deputy administrator, and, you know, asked me how I was doing. And I, you know, I said I was doing okay. And he said, you know, I know that you don't have any leave left, that you've exhausted absolutely all of it. And, you know, he said, my wife is just going back to work now full time. And our daughter is, I forget, she was 5 or 7 or something like that at the time. And so he said, I just want you to know that you can come and go and do whatever you need. And I don't want you to even worry about that. We can figure it all out. And it was all I could do, I think, not to just burst into tears in this man's office, just because he treated me so compassionately and just understood kind of the struggle that it was to come back to work. And so that is something that I have certainly carried with me and tried to apply to the other folks who work on my team.
You know, I think that is a great story. And I have 4 children and came back to work after all of them. And it, you're right. It's rough. It's rough going. And so to have an understanding boss makes all the difference in the world. And, you know, I think that when people think about, you know, the concerns about having women in executive positions or leadership positions, my experience has been that even those I think there's a saying, if you want to get something done, ask a busy mom to do it, right? Because my personal experience has been that when I have had women who work for me who had young children, maybe babies at home, they found a million different ways to get extra work done at night after they put the kids. And so do you have any secrets that you can share about how you do that?
I think that that's really it, you know, is I have left plenty of meetings with the deputy administrator at FEMA, or even sometimes the administrator, and said, it's time for me to, I got to pick up my kids. And, you know, they didn't skip a beat. It was perfectly fine. There was absolutely no judgment. And, you know, it didn't come back to haunt me later or any of that kind of stuff. So that is hugely important. Again, going back to the work for people that you respect and admire. And then also, I think that many of us do that. You know, we make it home so that we're there for dinner time with our kids and to do homework or, you know, play with them, whatever that is that you do in your family. And then after they go to bed, there are often things that you know, I go back and finish in terms of work.
We'll talk a little bit more about work-life balance in the next segment. But let me ask this. You've worked much of your career, but not all of it, with the federal government. It's really important that our government be able to recruit the best and brightest graduates coming out of colleges now. So how do you think, what's your perspective on how the government can compete with private sector to recruit, especially millennials coming into the workforce?
One of the things that's most appealing to me about working for the government is the ability to make decisions and have a direct effect, you know, on so many people. And that's really different than in the private sector. And one of the things that I found being in the private sector early in my career was that some of the folks in the government were making better money than we were in the private sector. So it can be, you know, it really is kind of what path you want to take. I mean, the federal government or government in general, whether state or local level, gives you great experience that it really is not possible to get anyplace else. And it can be challenging, however, to get into the government. So there are programs like the Presidential Management Fellow Program, or if you've been a Peace Corps volunteer, it's easier to get in, or certainly if you're a veteran. I just think it's a tremendous experience.
Today in the studio, we're talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator, FEMA. Coming up, we'll ask Katie about how she balances her work and family. You're listening to Women of Washington with Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we're talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator, FEMA. So, Katie, one of the questions before we get into work-life balance that we often ask our guests is about a chapter in Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, where she talks about your career not having to be a straight line, that it can be a jungle gym. Because many of the women that we have on the show, they've done lots of different work in different fields. Your career looks like it was absolutely a straight line. You got into preparedness relatively early on and have stayed the course. Has it been that way? Has it been as it seems?
It feels more like a jungle gym to me.
Does it?
I can see how looking at it, it seems like a straight line. I think part of why it feels like a jungle gym to me is that I didn't have it mapped out with any sort of precision. You know, I've gone from one thing that interests me to another thing that interests me. And of course, there's a common theme there. I didn't have the objective of becoming a senior executive at a federal government agency or anything. And so and maybe just because I'm still in the midst of it, it feels like a jungle gym. And perhaps I'll look back later and think, oh, that was much more of a straight line than I felt like it was at the time.
Well, you bring up an interesting point about having a plan versus not having a plan. One of the things that I find, particularly when I talk to younger people, millennials, is that they feel like they have this, there's a need that they should have 5-year, 10-year, 15-year plan all mapped out. And they stress about it if they don't. Yet it sounds like you didn't take that approach, that maybe you were just open to different opportunity.
I think so. And I think I just have been fortunate. I mean, I recognize the irony in somebody who's talking about family preparedness plans and all kinds of plans and saying, I didn't really have a plan when I went into this. I think it can be intimidating not to feel like you have a plan, and at the same time, that leaves you open, just as you said, to different opportunities. And I think it's about, you know, cultivating relationships with people, and then, you know, you kind of see where different colleagues end up. And that's how I ended up going from the private sector to the district government, was it someone who had been a client and with whom I'd cultivated a relationship, ended up leaving the federal government and going to the district. And when he got there, he said, hey, I'm looking for somebody to, you know, do a policy job for me. Would you be interested? And I said, absolutely. And similarly, how I ended up in the federal government, I think, so rather than kind of having a long-term plan or vision, which definitely works for some folks, what has worked for me is just, again, choosing those folks that I respect and admire and kind of cultivating those relationships.
So we're going to switch topics a little bit and go on to that, you know, infamous work-life balance, as if there really is such a thing. Right. I know that you have a young family, right? You have two sons,
is that right? Yep.
And so that must be interesting to try to find ways to balance home life and work life when they're, at an age where they still require a lot of attention. So how do you do it?
Interesting is a good word, you know, and I think sometimes I do it okay and sometimes not so well at all. And, I think it's what any of us do, which is just the best that we can in sort of working out with your spouse, your partner, if you're able to, kind of what that balance is. And so for me, I leave the office a little bit before 4:30, 2 or 3 days a week, so that I'm home at 5 o'clock. So I've got some quality time to spend with my boys, either running around outside or, you know, drawing or doing Legos or those kinds of things, and then making dinner and hanging out with them until bedtime. And, you know, some weeks that works. And, you know, when you're in the midst of one of the worst hurricane seasons in history, then it doesn't work well at all. And there's frankly no balance. And, you know, you come home to unhappy kids and an unhappy husband, and it's difficult for everybody, you know. But I think this is one area where kind of taking the long view makes sense. And, you know, I choose those events at my kids' schools or whatever it is, and just try to schedule everything around those so that I can do some of those things, but also explain to them that I can't do all of them. So like anybody else, you know, just trying to work it out.
Have there been times career-wise that you've had to make any tough decisions because of, a home life, you know, or family life?
There are absolutely things that I have not tried to do at work, or, you know, jobs that I have not tried to go for because they'd require too much travel, too much time away, or other things. And so I think all of us, you know, men, women, make those kinds of choices. What's the most important thing to you? Kind of what's that guiding principle? And try to make decisions based around that. And I am definitely not always successful there.
So I have to ask, given that your whole career has been in preparedness, are you that mom that, you know, when you show up, you've got the Kleenex and the Band-Aids and the ointments and the bee stings, you know, bug spray? And are you just like super prepared?
No, I am moderately. I'm saying medium prepared. You know, this is a sort of a funny story, is that, you know, we've got emergency supplies in our house and all of those kinds of things. And this goes back a couple of years, and we had a nanny, and there was a power outage in our neighborhood. And I realized, well, my husband and I know where the flashlights and all the stuff are, but I hadn't bothered to tell the nanny where they were. And so she was with our next door neighbor, and they own a hardware store. And he ended up bringing a lantern over and was giving me grief about it, saying, "You work at FEMA. How do you not have this around?" I thought, well, we do. We just hadn't made the plan for what we had to do. So that was a huge, you know, awakening moment for me. Oh, we've got somebody else who's in our house all day. We've got to lay all these things out. And so now we have them all in one place. And so, you know, I do some things well and other things we're still working on.
I guess that goes, you know, the old adage, the best laid plans, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's there's nothing like a small disaster to help you recognize, you know, where the holes in your plan were so that you can
exactly. You can
make it better for the next time.
Leaky pipes in a plumber's house.
That's right. Today in the studio, we're talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator, FEMA. So, Katie, I have to ask, what's next for you? Where do you see your career going in the next 5 to 10 to 15 years?
I wish I knew. I mean, I think it's kind of back to that question of not really having a plan. I mean, I am really enjoying my time at FEMA. I think we've got an absolutely tremendous team there and a group of colleagues that I appreciate and just really enjoy working with. And we also have been really fortunate to have great leadership. We've got a new administrator and a new deputy administrator and a chief of staff and others. And I really like what we're doing in the agency right now. And so for now, I'm good. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. And if there comes a point where I'm not, then I'll think harder about what I'd like to do next.
Okay. And last question for you. If you were to go back today and you were to see Katie walking across the graduation stage at the University of Wisconsin, what pieces of advice would you give her to have the same success that you've experienced in your career and your life?
I don't know that, I would have listened to any advice at that stage in my life. I mean, I think, you know, being bold is one thing. So, you know, make hard choices, do the hard things, do the right thing. Not that I haven't done those things, but I think just those kinds of words of encouragement are sort of principles to live by. But, you know, at age 22 or whatever, emboldened with a college degree and everything else, I don't think I was looking for a lot of advice.
Today in the studio, we've been talking with Katie Fox, Acting Deputy Administrator, FEMA.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Gigi Shum. Thanks for listening.